now to a story of love, language and the meaning of home, set in Brexit Britain. The award-winning Chinese-born British author, filmmaker and Booker Prize judge, Zhuolu Guo, is my guest. Zhuolu Guo's new book is A Lover's Discourse, and it's told through fragments of conversations between two unnamed lovers, which take place principally in a crowded East London flatshare, a drifting Regent's Canal barge and on a German farm. The novel centres on a relationship between an Australian-German architect and a Chinese PhD student who has moved to London in 2016 and is unable to find the word Brexit in her phrasebook. It's a tale of the challenges of learning a new language and living in a new culture. Literary magazine Granter includes Zhuolu Guo in its once-in-a-decade list of the 20 most promising young British novelists. She has been writer-in-residence at City University of New York, but is with us from London. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome. Lovely to have you with us. Could we begin with the novel? Could you introduce the audience to your narrator? She's an immigrant to Brexit-era London. She's studying a PhD. Tell us a little more of her arrival there and the plot, if we put it that way, of what you call a documentary novel.
Yeah, this is the most difficult task you ask a novelist to describe her own book. You know, we're going to be failed immediately, because often I think I write a book which has nothing to do with the original idea or original design. But I would just say something about this book. It's supposed to be a book I should have written long time ago, 17 years ago, when I left China, came to London. I was 29, but I began writing my first novel in English called A Concise Chinese English Dictionary for Lovers. And actually, that was a book, you know, it was the beginning of this novel. But it took me so many years to figure out, actually, even though that book was published a long time ago, it's a conversation between a man and a woman. Woman's from China. The man is an English artist. And it's written in broken English, in my very natural broken English then. But all these years passed, and I thought, actually, no, I need to rewrite that book. But of course, you know, so many years passed, and I think my idea of language, translation, or identities, an idea of a home, idea of country, especially Britain, and then again Europe, where I'm living now, changed completely in my mind. So here's the novel.
So now is the time for it, and it is a meditation on all those things. She's arriving, and again, this is this beautiful way by which language conveys so much. She's arriving in Brexit-era London, and there's no Brexit in the phrasebook. Straight away, we're confronted not just with the absence of a word, but with a whole experience to which she has arrived into.
That's right. I think, you know, the idea of the book, A Lover's Discourse, of course, very much inspired from French author Roland Barthes' A Lover's Discourse. And I think for me, how do I write a story about the idea of home and identity through a discussion between two lovers? And almost a love story is the simplest way to unfold this discussion linguistically and culturally. So in a way, you know, I feel like I'm just a conceptual artist, you know, trying to use that little form and somehow to put the message in it, you know. So you read this novel, A Lover's Discourse, is very simple. You know, the form is a very minimal form. You know, the man sees something, the woman often just oppose it or against it. And then they try to find some kind of common field. It's a book about communication, but then she's from Chinese background and her kind of profession is kind of anthropology, filmmaker, and he is landscape architect. So they are looking for the idea of home, which is very different of course, you know, in each other's mind, you know, they think they share something, but it's about difference of the two universe. And I think, yes, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I'm listening. It is exactly that. It is that even speaking the same language between two lovers, we are speaking a different language. We interpret through our own experiences, and it is about finding our way in everyday life between what one sees and what one intends and what the other receives.
Yeah, I think one episode of my life, which plays quite an important part of writing this book, I have to confess, you know, I spent some time in Switzerland, first in Zurich and then in Bern, because I was teaching there as a guest professor. And I think always somehow encountered the idea of the modern architecture when I was living in Switzerland. And often, you know, people I met there, you know, very much influenced by Le Corbusier's design. And I think for me, someone from agricultural background in China, and I grew up with rice fields, mountains, or, you know, fishing village, very naturalistic agricultural landscape. It was such a kind of opposite idea about what is beauty, what is modernity, you know, what is the key of modern architecture. And I think when I was there some years ago and I grew the idea of writing a book to do is, you know, how should we belong to this modern world through a landscape architect's point of view? And somehow I couldn't really use my own experience in that character. So I had to construct a male character who plays that role. And I could remain, you know, as kind of simple self in a way, you know, as a woman character who is kind of filmmaker, writer type. But I think that the idea in this book, is, you know, there's a few ideas. One is about home, the idea of modern home. And for her, is a personal private project. Looking for a home in the West is looking for identity. And that is a very traditional idea almost for immigrant, you know, looking for a new identity or old identity in a new land by somehow pinning down the land or the property or the house, you know, in a actual space. But for man, he's Anglo-Saxon, white European man, and then he's a landscape architect. For him, looking for home is looking for a playground to do the creative play, right? So it's kind of a complete different idea. You know, it's nothing to do with identity. His idea is to create a cosmic garden, basically, you know, for adulthood. And I think here's a conflict, you know, in their love and in their idea of finally finding a shared project together, you know, through this book.
Because they seek a sense of home in the traditional sense, a place to be and to rest one's head in all these different places. And again, this is where the language, the nuance of language is just infused in and out. For example, our narrator's confusion over using a word like flat as a place to live. You know, what a sad word to use for a home, a flat.
Yeah, I think these are, you know, really the idea come from when I was reading Le Corbusier's book, you know, one of the quite well-known article he wrote in the 1920s, Toward an Architecture. And those sentences like, a house is a machine to live in. I mean, if it's for someone from Zen Buddhist background or, you know, East Asian background, you think that is a horrible idea. A house is a machine to live in. And I think, you know, from a kind of East Asian background, you know, this is, you know, a house is somewhere, is a naturalistic heart without, you know, much manipulation. It should be completely organic in and out, within the body and outside the body. You know, you think of construct something completely, you know, kind of away from tradition is a key of the modern alienation. You know, our loneliness. How the loneliness began in modern society. And I think, for me, my personal experience of leaving China, came to the West to live, is such a, you know, intense and interesting experience, because I lived in different cities, first London, then I left. Then I went to Paris for two residences. One is for making film And then I stayed another year in the writer residence in Paris. And then I moved on again. Then I went to Berlin, did the DAAD artist residence, and was writing a film and a book. And then I came back to England again. Then I was, you know, away again in Switzerland, in Austria, doing those things, writing and teaching. And I think the concept of drifting and finding a home seems to be a hopeless project for someone, you know, like me, an immigrant from such a faraway cultural background. And I think all this experience somehow, you know, come to this book, Lover's Discourse, you know, it's kind of almost a debate about what is the key, you know, what is the warmth of our modern life. And yet, you know, because in this book it's only him and her, both has no names. And I think for me is, you know, a society is already composed by two persons. And this is two persons composing a probably larger society, you know, it's the foundation of a society. And also society is built on top of people have very different background, the social class system, all that. And what is a society, you know, from these two persons? You know, how should we build it?
Again, the use of metaphor, for example, when they are living on the barge, and it's not even properly anchored, I don't think. And again, is this giving us the idea of a rootlessness or a sense of being adrift? As they move through these different places, they try to find a home.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, in the very beginning, some idea was, you know, were very clear. For example, I wanted to use metaphor of boat, even though I live very close to Regent's Canal in London, East London, East North London. And it's kind of very interesting, industrial-looking canal. It's some parts quite beautiful, other parts very abandoned. You know, so this typical English industrial beauty, you know, with a decayness. And I thought about the character should just settle on this narrow boat, which many, many boats along the canal for a living. And often, you know, young couples cannot afford London housing or a certain kind of bohemian community, you know, say, well, we just live on a boat. Why should we surrender to this absurd housing market in England? So I thought this could be a great metaphor. You know, Britain now is a narrow boat. And how do we live, you know, co-live on this small, tiny boat, you know, underneath our feet and so drifting. And then so the couple just in and out and then try to find a much solid ground to launch their life. You know, so the discussion is, okay, now where we go? Go to Europe. So Europe is not a narrow boat, perhaps. You know, it's a land, it's a continent. So yeah, these things are not really a metaphor, but then again, it was kind of clear, you know, when I was writing a story.
Loneliness is evident here as well, and the loneliness again of trying to find your way in a new culture and to learn a new language. Why was the small lockkeeper's cottage on Regent's Canal such a comfort to our narrator?
Interesting. This is not very mysterious. I think a writer or a novelist like me started the book from some kind of interesting or almost a random emotional experience. And I think all these years I have lived in London, I somehow always lived by this canal in a different part of area. And I always walk along this canal, Regent's Canal. And this one particular lockkeeper's cottage, very beautiful. And I almost walk there today, actually. I'm not going to reveal which cottage it is. It's extremely poetic. And there's a few lockkeeper's cottages still there along this canal. And I guess in my early years, when I came to London, when I had no friends, nobody, you know, I was in a film school, which is outside of London, very far away. And I always lived there, and I passed that cottage, and I would just sit beside the cottage, look at the water. And somehow for me, that's a place for solace and a kind of soft place, imaginative place, you know, a peace away from silence of London, you know, away from political discussion, you know, all the depressing Tory government news. So, in a way, I thought this is something very personal, and I do need to locate that place, for the character.
How hard did your narrator feel it would be to become an English person? And was that her intent?
Maybe you need to ask me again
She
in a
was
different way.
trying to fit in. I'm referring perhaps to the Arsenal football game. She was trying to fit in, and how hard did she try?
Interesting. I think she is a character, now we're talking about she and him, which is very convenient. They have no names. And I think I decided all my future books, no one should have any name. Once we have name, it's this kind of idea of we have to identify with Peter or Ben or Mary or Lucy. I think it's very difficult because for a Chinese person, why should I identify with these Western names? Anyway, so come back to that. I think she is certainly trapped in her own cultural identity and the shadows of political or propaganda power in her life and in her memory. Therefore, I think, for her, it's very difficult to throw away, to abandon the whole cultural baggage and inheritance, to be completely, to be absorbed by another culture, or whether linguistically or culturally. And for him, perhaps also similar, but for him, it's easier because this is his land, whether he's Australian, German, or something a bit more complicated. It is a cozy, comfortable Anglo-Saxon white European tradition. He doesn't need to go out to Japan or China to be nobody, to be completely lost in the alien landscape. And yet this is, it just, again, we're in this post-colonial world, is unequal exchange, is a one-way boat. Still, it's strange, unequal society, culturally speaking. For us, I think when I was in the school in China, we have to learn everything to do with Shakespeare or Dickens or the Western canons. And then on top of that, our thousands of years old Asian history, all the dynasty, all the poems. But if you go to an English school or German school, do they learn the canons from East Asia? No, maybe not. So I think it creates such a gap, in the communication. And that's the frustration in a society. And this book is about two persons. Two persons is a society, is a foundation of society.
His experience is very different from hers, to your point. He is a white man in Britain, and although he might have used his English differently from native-born British people, his treatment and his experiences were still very different from hers, from our narrator.
Absolutely. I think there's one discussion in the book in the middle part when she goes to China to make a film about this artisan village. And then there's kind of pseudo dialogue, but it's not real dialogue, it's the internal dialogue between him and her. And she is sort of asking, does an architecture construct memory, or our memory is being constructed by architecture? And she asks this question, is almost asking, where should we belong to? She returns to her country, but her hometown is already disappeared from the map. Basically, her home village is a kind of highway, with 8 lanes, driveways in different direction. And perhaps, the same home address is now some kind of, say, number, numbered by the motorway or different traffic lights, the whole basic control center. And there's so many people from the third world have suffered the loss of the complete loss of the home village or the idea of a home. Yet in Europe, still you can trace back your identity, your family tree, even your village, So, and this is the profound difference, how our society progress and how powerful architecture, or especially modern architecture, change our memory. Actually, it's not the other way around. And so this kind of battle between him and her is through those conceptual ideas. And I think that's why I was mentioning Le Corbusier in the beginning, because I started thinking about this novel, you know, from that point when I was thinking about modern architecture and the landscape. I know this is quite away from your question, but we can come back to your question.
No, I understand it. It is writing as more than letters or markings on a page. That is, that this infuses your writing and infuses your thinking. And I'm wondering how writing in English, how difficult it is sometimes to express what you really want to express. Do you find it a limiting language in some ways as a writer?
This is a very good question. You know, it's really the core of my struggle, basically, as a writer in a foreign language, because you really see the problem, or, you know, sometimes people call that strength, an advantage. When I was writing Chinese, you know, 30 years I've been writing Chinese, publishing Chinese books in China, and I didn't see language. It's strange. You know, the language is this fortress. I couldn't feel my language as a Chinese author because I never left this country. It was comfortable. It was strange, but comfortable. I didn't even understand I was using one particular language until the moment I left China. As a writer, linguistic identity is your only identity, almost. And then suddenly I lost my identity as a writer. When I came to the UK, because I studied art, so I didn't study English or, you know, proper grammar, anything, I had to really begin completely from zero to write, because I couldn't make film right away in the West. You can be a stateless writer, but you cannot be a stateless filmmaker, because finding film funding, you do need a state, you know, a society to support you. But write a little book, you may as well be a lonely, desolate person. You know, you can do that in a way. But I think facing the loss of my native language also meaning I have this mental freedom, you know, from this enormous disadvantage. So I was this kind of idiotic, disabled person, you know, with my tool. I don't have a tool, but then somehow I thought I could finally write something I couldn't really write when I was living in my native country. You know, a lot of themes, sexuality, you know, political discussion. And also the form completely changed when I switched to write in English. My novels look strange, you know, they're all looking like little essays putting together, which is very different from, you know, the idea of writing a novel with solid stories and plots. And once I began in that language, well, in English as I'm speaking now, funny English, I couldn't really go back to writing in Chinese. So to answer your question, I feel, you know, this is a process I'm going through. Still, I'm trying to grasp a certain particular English language I should form rather than just, you know, particular, you know, I'm not using British English or American English to write, or Singapore English. It's a certain kind of English I can conduct and with my own kind of signature and style. So this is, I guess, the long march I'm going through in my life.
Equally, as we said, you called your book, you call your books documentary novels. The idea of something being non-fiction or fiction, is that category just not real for you? The author is inevitably present in the book.
I found it troublesome when I began to write something immediately if the concept of fiction or non-fiction entered into my mind. I found it very destructive because it stops the flow of this supposed free mind and supposed free hands. So to create is not to be worried about this should be journalistic, should be factual checked, or it should be just a wandering of the mind or poetic nonsense. And I really find, you know, very difficult to just pin down myself in one form or the other. So the same when I make films, for example, you know, most films documentary looking, and even my fiction films, you know, the biggest fiction film I ever made called UFO in Our Eyes with very big budget, more than a million budget some many years ago. But that is largely based on the improvisation documentary footage. For me, I think I see myself as kind of, you know, someone from maybe it's a post-school called Art Brut, you know, which means, you know, a bunch of disabled, perhaps, you know, people have mental issues, or people come from impoverished resource or background, try to invent their art from their internal voice rather than surrender to marketing, you know, catalog, you know. Somehow that doesn't work for me. And I feel always, you know, all my life I felt I'm a guerrilla filmmaker, or I'm a guerrilla gardener, you know, I'm a guerrilla writer. I cannot somehow walk on this same track, you know, each time. And I'll just, you know, off track, you know, making this novel looking completely like an essay, or making that fiction film looking like documentary. And indeed, actually, in this novel, there's a part when she goes back to China making this film about artisans painting Leonardo da Vinci's classical work. I made a film during that time too. I didn't go back to that village in China, was making a film, and that's part of my research of my novel. I couldn't say, you know, I mean, the film already came out before the novel, because the publication takes 2 years, and I made a film within 3 months, and I launched the film by myself. But it says overlapping between the novel and the film, my films. So I couldn't call, you know, what they are, you know, they are documentary novels. You mean, you know, sometimes I say, do you mean this film or that novel? There's a lot of overlapping, you know, areas.
What were you saying, by the way? No, I understand it entirely. What were you saying, by the way, in this part of the book, where, as you've just alluded to, our narrator's PhD study of a Chinese village, where there's this reproduction of Western paintings happening for Western consumers. What is the message of that scene?
It's interesting, because I could answer you, you know, in a simple way, maybe because of time on the radio. But it goes back to a very long intellectual nonsense. When I was in university in China, I was kind of very much in love with Walter Benjamin's writing. And of course, you know, the most well-known essay he wrote, The Art in the Mechanic, The Age of Art in the Mechanical Reproduction, was very powerful influence on me, because it made me to think, you know, what is cinema? Cinema is kind of reproduction of reality, which has nothing to do with the idea of authenticity. Yet, you know, in the painting world, in the visual art world, we still, you know, surrender to the idea of the authenticity. And I was just somehow trying to make a film essay around the Walter Benjamin's essay. And then after so many years, you know, say 25 years, I said, okay, now I found this place. It's called a Dafan Village in Shenzhen near Hong Kong. Once I found it, I took my camera, I flew, I went to the village and I lived there. Then I was making that film about artisans painting. And my film was about this artisan peasant painting a very famous Caravaggio painting called St. John in the Wilderness. But of course, in my novel, it's Da Vinci's Virgin on the Rock. So, of course, you know, there's slightly difference. But, you know, I can't say what's a clear message, but I think it's this debate about what is the authenticity when the capitalism basically removed the simplest joy and even, you know, the entertaining value of the artwork should be. You know, how do we these days participate, you know, the viewing of the art or the supposed expensive classical art, when a very rich person, you know, possess a Da Vinci's work, a piece of painting, you know, how does that work for the mass, for the laborers, you know, for the people who are reproducing those paintings just to sell for another middle-class person, say, look, please, we're also allowed to look at what is about Mona Lisa. Can we hand a Mona Lisa in our living room? And can we understand why, what a fuss, you know, what is a huge deal historically about this painting? So it's about, in a modern society, in a reproduction world, you know, controlled by the commercial capitalism, you know, how do we view the value of art? And indeed, what is authenticity? Because it comes back to the final, you know, product, say Apple computer is the product, you know, what is real Apple computer and what is a fake one, when those are produced basically by the same Chinese laborers, right? And it's just a brand issue. And it was, this discussion, I couldn't really conduct longer in the novel, but I would actually use other chance to discuss.
We first meet the narrator's mother in the book at her father's funeral. And the mother's bought her own burial plot and installed a headstone, leaving the daughter just to chisel the date of her death on it so that, you know, you're not paying someone else to do it. How much of this is an insight into the painful parts of your early life?
All my books are very close to my life. I don't think I can write a complete, you know, fantastic fiction with, you know, with big war and peace. But I try to render my generation, you know, the Chinese people with my, you know, with similar age, that kind of desolation we went through after the Cultural Revolution. My experience, which, you know, my early years, this kind of homeless, basically, sort of abandoned a childhood. A person didn't have a childhood because my father was in the labor camp. And my mother was first a Red Guard, and then she became a factory worker full time. How many hours a day, I didn't even know then. But my bleak living experience is really a generation's life, or even continued after my generation, I dare say. And that is a result of, you know, after 1949, after the Communist Revolution took over China, and China under Mao, you know, the whole transition, how to turn this poverty-ridden post-opium war or post-imperial China into a modern China with some kind of industry alongside the big brother Russia ahead of us and the American imperialism ahead of Chinese people. So that kind of historical stage produced a rather hard, bleak society, which means all the adults working 20 hours a day, no sleep. All the children left for their, you know, for their illiterate grandparents. And this huge alienation and the generation gap produced between parents and the children. And also the society then, you know, it's about dedicating your love to the state, all your energy, passions for the state, for the Communist Party. So it could be, you know, everyone would experience this very loveless, you know, the poverty of love, but also indeed the poverty of material, the ultimate material deprivation we had. And I still remember, I think, the first time I saw a bulb with electricity, something like around maybe 9 or 10 years old, you know, the first time there's electricity in a bulb hanging down on the ceiling. And I remember one of the grandfather in the village, in my village, you know, a grandpa has this smoking pipe or the pipe, and he saw this electricity in the bulb suddenly on, controlled by somewhere, you know, in the village. And he found a bench. He said, well, let me stood on the bench so I can light my pipe. And he waited, and he waited that the pipe didn't really, you know, being lit by the electricity bulb. I remember that moment. It was just such a shocking moment. You know, what is this? You know, electricity. And indeed, it reminds me of Lenin, you know, when the Western people, you know, ask Lenin, what is communism? And I think it's kind of funny quoting communism, he answered the first line, what is communism? You know, it's kind of working class labor become the center of the society. But communism meaning also means electricity. Something like that, a quotation. I thought, what a reality actually I did experience, even though I was so young then. But, you know, that kind of reality. And I think we still have this traumatic memory of great famine in China, you know, in the early 50s, in the end of 50s. And that is bodily painful still, you know, and then it creates our mind these days.
Do you have your own explanation of what home is? Have you found your home? And if so, what is it?
Always an interesting question because I can't really answer. Each time I think my readers very kindly, warmly ask me this question. Till today, I would say, you know, my first 20 years, I live as kind of a simple young woman, try to understand what is life, and I'm still trying to live like that. But really, for the last 30 years, I would say 25 years, I live as this crazed artist, making films every year, writing books every year, doing teachings, traveling, try to discover the world through my work. And I do think home is where my work is happening. You know, I think when I was writing a book in Budapest or even in Hong Kong, I feel home, I forget where I was. And this is like a horrible situation because home is no longer a physical concept and no longer a material concept. It's really this almost a workaholic person, you know, tied her identity onto. And of course, these days, you know, I become much more, let's say, mellow. The idea of home is where, you know, my family would be, or a place somehow politically more bearable than another place. And that could be many, many places, but nature, again, you know, it's a final answer. You know, I think I couldn't live in the place without nature.
Thank you. And thank you for the book. Our guest is Joao Lu Guo. The book is A Lover's Discourse. And it is a wonderful read.